I don't think it would be as draconian as nobody in and nobody out, but there'll be, if we continue to get cases like this, particularly at the community level, there will be what we call mitigation, where you'll have to do essentially social distancing, keep people out of crowded places, take a look at seriousness, do you really need to travel, those kinds of things.
Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, speaking to Fox News yesterday, he was responding to a question about Italy's response to the coronavirus and whether a similar quarantine could happen here. Well, today, Italy expanded the weekend's lockdown across the entire country. 60 million people now included in the quarantine. We're going to talk about that now with Rachel Donadio. She's been writing about this for The Atlantic. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, what did the prime minister say about this entire country lockdown?
Well, today, Monday, Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte went on national television and told Italians that this is really for the good of the country, for the public good, that people should stay home. He said, "Io resto a casa," meaning I'm staying home decree, And he said that it had just basically become a public health emergency, that in order to prevent emergency rooms and intensive care units from becoming overwhelmed, that people should just not leave home unless absolutely necessary. He said that it was just time to be responsible and that public health had to be placed above other concerns, meaning certain economic concerns. Pretty much.
Yeah. So what does that mean, staying home? That means that there's no travel within the country, or you're not allowed to leave the country, or both?
Well, the restrictions over the weekend were that you weren't allowed to leave these areas of the north, including these productive areas that are responsible for a large part of Italy's GDP, the areas around Milan. Presumably what this means, and the details are still forthcoming, is that you just really shouldn't leave your immediate area. You should not travel unless you absolutely have to. And again, it's not martial law. There is movement of goods and people. Necessary work is a reason to leave. There is movement of goods and people. If you have significant, serious work reasons, you can travel for that. But you can also travel if there's a health issue, and you can travel for other needs, like to check in on ailing relatives if you're careful of the contagion. What this also means is that there's a law. This is a law. So you need a certificate that you can fill out yourself declaring this is why I need to travel. And it has to be honest. It has to be true. If you're falsifying it, then you get in trouble. But there are fines that will be imposed if you don't. It's basically like I need a hall pass, and they have to check on that.
And there were more deaths today, right? So now Italy has surpassed South Korea in the number of cases.
You know, every day the number of deaths has gone up. On Saturday, it was 233 deaths in Italy. On Sunday, 366. And today, Monday, 463. So the number of deaths has been rising dramatically. And that's really why these measures were put in place. It's overwhelming the intensive care units, especially in Lombardy, the wealthy region of the north that has the highest number of cases and that's been hit the hardest. Some people get this virus and they basically have a little bit of a cold and it's really no big deal. And other people get dramatic respiratory failure. It's a lung infection and they need to be put on respirators, and there aren't enough respirators. That is really the issue.
So a doubling of deaths, practically a doubling since Saturday. That's remarkable.
Yeah. It's just something that's been creeping over Italy slowly in the last few weeks. And you have to think about it. I mean, the measures that were put in place this weekend that put a lot of the north on lockdown, let's call it. Restaurants could be open from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., but you have to sit 1 meter away. But, you know, you think the virus doesn't travel after 6 p.m.? I mean, it's kind of some of these decisions are somewhat not arbitrary, but first they targeted the parts of Italy that were hardest hit. But it's a virus. It travels across borders. It knows no borders. So really, the issue is to just try to keep people from limiting other human contact because the virus is so contagious.
Yeah. So why is Italy the center of this outbreak in Europe?
I think there are a bunch of different reasons. One is that early on, there was this patient named Mattia, we only know his first name, who was a healthy 38-year-old, and he came down with symptoms in a town outside Milan, and he went to the emergency room, and they didn't realized that there was this deadly virus going around, so they kind of treated him there, and he wound up infecting a lot of people in the hospital and in the small town where he lived. So it spread quite quickly around there before people understood that it must, you know, that it needed to be really contained. Another issue is I just think the way Italians are, you know, there's a lot of hugging and small town life, and you kind of live within contact of your family and this and that, and, you know, everyone comes into a lot of human contact. That's not only the case in Italy, but it's particularly true there. You greet people with a kiss on both cheeks. Another issue is really that it was spreading in hospitals where the most fragile and at-risk patients, older people, were not making it, and it was spreading to them. And it was only after they died that then they were tested and they discovered that some of these patients had it. It's really something that put the old and frail at greater risk. Italy is one of the oldest countries in the world. It has the second oldest population in the world after Japan. And so if it's spreading around hospitals, it's going to hit really hard.
Wow. So you paint a picture of life in Italy as one that, as you know, we've all seen or experienced, is one of a lot of conviviality, a lot of going out and be socializing and, as you say, kissing on the cheeks and touching. So how has all this changed life in Italy?
Well, it's been changing slowly, and really it started changing in Milan and areas around there in the last few weeks, but there was a lot of confusion, and it was only this weekend when the measures were introduced that people were told to not touch and just stay away, social distancing, that it really began to sink in that this is actually something really serious and you have to take it seriously. A few weeks ago, the government was kind of saying it's business as usual. And one of the political leaders, the leader of the Democratic Party, which is a governing party, a center-left party, went to Milan and drank an aperitivo and said, oh yeah, you know, Milan isn't stopping, everything's fine. And then he announced on Saturday that he had come down with the virus. So it's really, I think, initial attempts to downplay it have now really, really, I wouldn't say backfired, but have just, you know, the battle plan is good until the battle begins, and Italy has changed strategy, but for really good reason, because the death count keeps going up. I mean, I just got a message from a friend of mine in Milan, and she said, you know, Rachel, tell people, just take this seriously. At the beginning, we were all calm about this, but now all you hear are ambulances, and you start to hear more and more cases of people you know who have been somehow affected. I mean, it was really harrowing to get that note from her just a few minutes ago, because again, you know, as recently as last week, it's like, oh, we're still having an aperitivo, we're Italians, everything's fine. I think you cannot enforce that 60 million people stay at home. But if you send such a strong message from the top, it makes people realize that this is something really serious and they should just limit their movements as much as possible within the confines of a free and democratic society. That's really one of the things we're facing here. This is the free movement of people and information and goods meets the free movement of this virus that knows no boundaries.
Rachel DiNadio from The Atlantic, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming up, a cruise ship that's been sitting off the San Francisco coast docks in Oakland. Some people on it are sick, so it's going to take a long time to get people off, maybe days. So what's next for the thousands of people on board? That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. A cruise ship carrying more than 3,000 people has docked in the Oakland Harbor just days after being forced to stay off the coast of San Francisco. At least 21 people on board have tested positive for the new coronavirus. Because of that, all American passengers on the ship will be quarantined for 2 weeks at military bases across the country, including two here in California. Federal health officials are now saying all Americans, especially the elderly, should avoid cruise ships altogether. Joining us to talk about the continuing problems on the Grand Princess is Erin Aylworth. She covers disasters and trauma for The Wall Street Journal. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. So 21 people tested positive for COVID-19. Most of them were crew members. How did they get it? Do we know?
Well, before this cruise, which was to Hawaii, the Grand Princess was on a cruise from San Francisco to Mexico and back. And on that trip, there was an elderly person who later died. He was the first person in California to die from COVID-19 after he was hospitalized in Placer County. So where he was exposed is unclear. It could have been before the trip. It could have been on the cruise. We're not sure yet. But Princess says that it first learned of that passenger sometime around March 2nd.
So it's thought that perhaps he infected the crew members, or at least he was responsible for their infections, and then they may have spread it to others?
Exactly. You know, a lot of the crew that tested positive, there were 19 of them, only two passengers tested positive. So it seems like the crew probably had more exposure to the coronavirus.
All right. So what happens when everyone gets off this boat? There's thousands of people on this boat, right?
Yeah, there are something like 2,400 passengers, about 960 of them California residents. And that's not including, obviously, the crew, of which there are about 1,100. And so what happens is they're going to take the people with symptoms and the most acute care needs off first, right? And then they're going to start with the California passengers, and they're going to give them health assessments and take them to these bases that have been identified, including one in Travis, and put them in isolation there and quarantine for 14 days.
And does everyone get swabbed for the coronavirus?
That's what it sounds like at the moment. So, you know, that's exactly what Health and Human Services said yesterday.
Okay, so there are enough tests for everybody.
We hope so. I mean, you know, obviously there's been a lot of frustration over the availability of COVID-19 test kits because mm-hmm. supply really hasn't kept up with demand. And so that has translated into a lack of access for people who are saying, you know, hey, I've got some worrisome symptoms, and even their doctors, you know, might find them worrisome. But it does sound like there are enough test kits for this.
Because you
I guess
can
we
be,
just have to wait and see.
Yeah, I guess so, because you can be asymptomatic but still have the virus and possibly spread it.
That's right. You know, for a lot of people, you can have very mild symptoms. You might not even know that you're carrying.
So many people have asked why this ship was sent to Oakland, because it was off the coast of San Francisco. So why not disembark there? And here's what Governor Newsom said yesterday.
The logistics of that site along the Embarcadero, the proximity to residences, the disruption that would have ensued was such that we determined that was not the appropriate site.
All right. So some people in Oakland are saying, hey, that's not cool, right?
Right. And the governor did address this in that press conference yesterday. I did listen to it. And he basically said, you know, there were a couple of sites that were under consideration, including one in Alameda, but that ultimately the Port of Oakland rose to the top for a couple of reasons. And those were proximity to an airport and also just the ability to secure the site.
Right. And so is there any fear at all that this virus could escape into the broader community?
I mean, I think given the situation, there is always that fear, right? We've seen this virus spread pretty quickly, with some cases where we don't know where it originates. And so you just have to be very vigilant. You know, there have been protocols that are put in place for quarantining. You've got your first responders on the front line, you know, trying to wear the appropriate protective gear. Although, of course, as you know, there's been a run on N95 masks and other supplies. So some of those have become difficult to get. So I do think it is a legitimate concern that that, you know, this could spread further, and we just have to be very vigilant about our protocols.
Yeah. Well, meanwhile, as you say, this is the second time there's been a problem with this particular ship and the Grand Princess, but other cruise ships have had problems too, and now federal health officials are advising Americans, well, don't get on a cruise ship if you don't have to. What does this mean for the cruise ship industry?
Well, they are expecting to take a pretty big hit. Some estimate that cancellations for this year could reach 50% and that bookings for next year could fall by an even higher percentage. So obviously that is going to ripple out.
Yeah. And the government can basically force ships to remain docked.
Yeah, we saw that over the weekend. On Saturday, Princess canceled a 7-day Royal Princess cruise to Mexico from L.A. because the CDC issued a no-sail order. That was essentially because health officials wanted to test a crew member who had been transferred onto that ship from the Grand Princess 2 weeks ago. And they did the same thing with another ship, the Regal Princess, which was held offshore of Florida, because of some crew members there that they wanted to test. Now, those tests for the Regal Princess crew members did come back negative.
Still, this is not the first time the cruise ship industry has had this kind of problem with viruses.
No, I think, you know, given that they are an enclosed space at sea, you've got a lot of people in a lot of proximity. Illness and the transfer of illness is something that the cruise industry has long battled with. And right now we just are dealing with a virus that is fast moving and that we don't yet have a treatment for.
Erin Aylworth covers disasters and trauma for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for joining us.
Absolutely.
California is not the only state dealing with quarantines as this virus spreads. In Washington state, at least 19 people have died, most of them at a nursing home outside Seattle. The governor there, Jay Inslee, says he's considering mandatory measures to cut down the number of public activities there. Yesterday, one of the federal government's leading disease experts said regional lockdowns may become necessary. It's Monday, so that means Jessica Levinson is here to talk about legal issues and what the power the U.S. government has in situations like that. This. She's a law professor at Loyola Law School and our regular legal. Hi.
Hi.
All right. So as we just heard, the Californians coming off that cruise ship will be quarantined at Travis or another airbase. So what is the legal power for the government to do that, to say, even if you're healthy, even if you don't have any signs of a virus, you're going to be quarantined?
In a word, vast. So we have power from the federal government, the state government, and county government. So every level of government has the power to say, basically, oh, we're scared out of our minds by you. If you could just stay over there in that semi-undesirable area, that would be great. And now, you know, to take it a bit more seriously, where does the federal government have power? Mm-hmm. Both from the Constitution, a clause called the Commerce Clause, and from a statute. Where do states have power? And states typically will take the lead. States have power because they have really broad powers called police powers. They're basically to keep us healthy and safe. And counties then have powers from the states. So, you know, for anyone who would want to challenge these types of actions, it really is an uphill battle.
Well, how far could it go? I mean, it's one thing to take people off a ship and put them in a quarantine for 14 days. It's another thing to say, okay, all of Los Angeles, you can't leave the city limits, or no one can come into the city limits.
So I think the best way to think about it is, if it's almost like an earthquake, potentially, where we have warning. So what could the government do to try and mitigate the damage from a natural disaster? Now, we don't have tornadoes and hurricanes. And the answer is that they could do things like implement curfews. They could tell us not to leave our homes. And so the government
like martial law, basically.
Yeah, the government has a lot of power. I mean, if you think about after, I know this is a long time ago, but I think it was 1991, the Rodney King riots, mm-hmm. where we implemented curfews. Mm-hmm. And so the government can tell people, you don't get to go here. You don't get to move around in this space. I mean, how far can it go? There is very explicit power that the government has, particularly state governments, to say you need to isolate yourself. You can't leave your house. Right now, we're not there. It's still largely voluntary. Yeah. It's still largely just a campaign of trying to inform people.
Hope they self-quarantine.
Hope that they have just enough fear, mm-hmm. right, to pull a Ted Cruz.
Well, can the government shut down private businesses?
So I think that that is not where we are right now. But yes, the government does have the power to, if they think, again, it rises to that level. Now, we have never tested kind of the outer bounds of this power before, but I would say that if the government can show this is for health and safety, there's an epidemic or a pandemic, then can it tell businesses to shut down or to severely, more likely, to severely restrict how they conduct their business? Yes.
So in response to a tweet from a passenger on that cruise ship we were just talking about, the ACLU tweeted, even in a public health emergency, the government must make every effort to ensure our rights remain protected. This includes due process rights to appeal confinement and the right to legal counsel. How would you go through that? How would you appeal confinement?
In a terrifically laborious way. So a lot of these challenges, to the extent that they're going to happen, first have to go through a government agency. So think about the CDC or think about Health and Human Services, where first you have to say, now the statute in federal law, the statute basically empowers the CDC to do what it needs to do. So first you have to say, CDC, you didn't do this correctly. Then you have to go through that appeals. Then you can go outside to the court system and you try and find a judge who is willing to be the judge that says, I don't trust the government's judgment on this particular health and safety call. So I'm going to go ahead and go against the advice of presumably the experts and say that you should, in fact, be let out free mm-hmm. to society.
Well, I mean, on a much darker note, we saw that during World War II with the internment of Japanese Americans.
Absolutely. So, I mean, and some significant differences between those two, mm-hmm. but that was also based on a fear of staying safe.
Right.
And we saw in that case, I think the court system didn't play its proper role and did actually make some really egregious decisions.
Yeah, and defer to what the federal authorities wanted to do.
Right. But I think that it shows actually how much judges will be reticent to say, I'm going to be the judge who's going to go against the other branch of the government. I'm going to be the judge who says, I don't agree with the quarantine or I don't agree with the internment camps.
Right. And by the time the appeals process works its way through, the quarantine would be over, presumably.
Right. So presumably by the time you would go through the CDC and then the court system, at that point, we would know whether or not the quarantines are worthwhile, whether or not they're not. Now, there's always the chance that you would want someone to be able to go through the court system because they're testing limits, not just for them, but for people going forward, which means that it wouldn't, you know, it wouldn't be for nothing. Mm-hmm. But as of right now, we're not seeing those challenges. It's basically just that tweet from the ACLU.
Okay, so let's turn to another story in the news. Federal officials announced today that former LA City Councilman Mitch Englander has been charged with all sorts of crimes involving obstruction. He's been accused of accepting cash, escort services, hotel rooms, extravagant meals during trips to Palm Springs and Las Vegas from a businessman who is apparently working with the FBI. What can you tell us about this?
This is not good. I can tell you this is not good news for Mitch Englander.
Nope.
These are serious federal charges. I believe he's the first Los Angeles city official to be charged in this pretty broad federal corruption probe that we know has been going on for a number of years. And it's interesting, what he's charged with isn't the fact that he may have accepted these, you know, cash in an envelope or the, I think there's a comment about a massage lady or that he had, you know, extravagant meals and very nice hotels that were funded by this businessman who apparently wanted to increase his business in Los Angeles. But the charges are based on lying about it. It's always, you know, there's that old saying, it's always the cover up.
Yeah.
And in this case, there's 7 counts, 3 for witness tampering, 3 for making false statements, 1 for a conspiracy to falsify facts. So that's not to say that if he had told the truth, he would have been in no trouble. But it is to say that these charges aren't based on the substance of what he did, but essentially his decision to try and thwart the investigation and to ask other people also to lie about it.
Allegedly, there is an exchange of cash that happened in a Las Vegas bathroom, hotel bathroom, like $10,000, allegedly, according to this indictment. And that's not considered a crime?
I'm not saying that's not considered a crime. I think that there are serious issues surrounding. I mean, let's just take a step back and say none of these stories are complete until you have the cash in an envelope in a bathroom in Las Vegas.
Exactly.
And then you can really just close the scene on that. But so it is altogether likely that there could be a situation where that does give rise to federal charges. Now, Los Angeles city officials are limited in the amount of campaign donations they can get, the gifts they can receive, from who they can receive those gifts. So there's plenty of potential state and federal laws that are at issue, only to say that I think what the low-lying fruit here was actually just him trying to obstruct the investigation to learn about the cash in the envelope in the hotel room in Las Vegas. It was worth repeating one more time.
Absolutely. And I guess additional charges could come later. You never know.
They could come later. You know, the fact that federal officials came forward with these means that they're most confident with these. And, you know, we'll see where this goes. My guess is not trial, that there will be some sort of bargain that's made.
Gotcha. There are other people involved, after all.
There are. And key to this will be what exactly they said to federal investigators.
Jessica Levinson, our regular Monday legal and a law professor at Loyola Law School. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, a day without women in Mexico and Cool from Cool and the Gang on how they came up with their memorable songs.
And my wife and I, we used to hang out in New York, and then on the weekends, there was always a ladies' night. So I said, wow, that's a great idea. Let me take that back to the guys. I said, hey, I got a perfect song for this album. They said, oh, what? I said, ladies' night, man.
And voila, a hit is made. That's coming up next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Thousands of women in Mexico are striking today. They're not going to work or to school or participating in the economy. They're calling it a day without women. Yesterday, on International Women's Day, 80,000 women took to the streets to demand that the Mexican government do more to protect them against increasing violence there. Violence, specifically against women, has escalated in recent years. An average of 10 women are killed every single day in Mexico. Joining me now is Carrie Kahn, NPR's international correspondent in Mexico City. Hey, Carrie.
Hi, Madeline.
So what does it look like, a day without women?
It looks pretty empty. It looks like a holiday here, even a holiday weekend. I'd say it was that drastic when there's no traffic out on the street. It's pretty amazing in this traffic-clogged city.
Wow. And so what was the, if there was one, an official reaction on the part of the president or anyone else?
Well, we still have to see if there's any sort of numbers. It's going to be hard to gauge this. The president did give his morning 7 a.m. weekday press conference, and half the seats were empty because that's usually the women reporters there. So there has been a big abstention. I was in the metro early this morning, and they have separate metro cars for women because they face incredible harassment, groping, unwanted touching. robberies when they're in the cars with the men. And the women's cars, there's about four of them in every train that goes by, were just pretty empty. It was pretty amazing. The police officer there was telling me that it was just, she's never seen anything like it. And the men's cars, where they were packed like sardines in there. So you could definitely see that there was a difference. And up on top, above the ground, like I said, traffic was just really great. I went to the corporate headquarters of L'Oreal, which has a workforce of about 70% women, and the offices were just empty. It's about 5 kilometers from my office. It usually can take about 45 minutes to an hour to get there. I got back in 15 minutes.
Wow.
So you can feel it. Women are absent today.
And women are furious. What is driving this? I know there have been a couple of really brutal killings in the last month.
Yeah, just gruesome cases of women being murdered. They call them femicide cases here, that they're targeted because of their gender, usually by a male partner, husband, a relative. There were two cases that really galvanized this outpouring of anger and protest that we're seeing now. There was a 25-year-old woman who was brutally killed, and this is gruesome. She was skinned She was skinned by her male partner. And then just days after that, there was another case here in Mexico City of this 7-year-old girl who was abducted from her school. She was sexually assaulted and murdered. So those two cases, just one after another, seem to just galvanize people and make this anger that has been seething here even more palpable. You know, they say on average 10 women are murdered a day in Mexico, and that number has risen greatly in the last couple years as violence overall in Mexico has skyrocketed here. Mm-hmm. But it was those two cases that just really seemed to get to people and take to the streets.
Yeah, I can understand why. So this is actually the second day of protest, right? Because yesterday, women turned out into the streets to demonstrate. What was that like?
I've really never seen anything like it here. You know, the Me Too movement in Mexico has had sort of little sputters and kind of stalled starts. There's been certain sectors, maybe actors and have gotten together, or, you know, artists. There was a short-lived thing about reporters, female reporters trying to call out sexual harassment and in their workplace. But, you know, it's never really gotten going just as it did in the States in the last couple of years. And this is just something that's never been seen before. You know, in Mexico City, they say the numbers were 80,000. That's officially what the city said. But if you look at aerial footage of just blocks and blocks and blocks of women from, if you know Mexico City, from all the way from the Alameda down blocks past the beautiful Fine Arts Museum down into the historic center, was filled with people. And everybody liked to say, too, everybody was wearing purple. And this is the season now where the beautiful jacaranda trees in Mexico bloom, too. So just the whole place was flooded in purple.
Wow.
And so I've never seen such a massive group of women before. I was actually in the northern city of Monterey, which is a much more prosperous area. A lot of international companies are there. And the women that were out, every time I talked to somebody, they were with their moms, they were with their sisters. People were discussing, you know, horrible acts of violence that they have survived. But there were also a lot of young professional women. And I talked to a physicist, a couple lawyers, a lot of engineers, and they just said how hard it was to hold these non-traditional roles, jobs in Mexico, and the discrimination they face. Like, they go to a work site, and this one engineer woman told me, she said, every time I go there, they always say, oh, are you the intern? Are you the young student? Are you the assistant? Get me coffee. And she said, no, I'm the boss. You know, just what they have to go against. And we're not even talking just about violence. We're just talking about discrimination and the fight for equal rights in Mexico. It's pretty amazing. And talking to mothers that were there with their daughters, as one woman I was interviewing, tears were just streaming down her face as she said, I wish I had had the courage to come out earlier and protest like this, so my children wouldn't have to live in a Mexico so violent today.
Wow. That is,
it was intense.
That sounds really, really intense. Is there anything specific that the leaders of this movement are calling for besides an end to the violence?
Well, and into the violence, an awareness of the situation that women face in here, the harassment that they face on the street. One woman a young woman I talked to, she was really interesting. She just was wearing a very short skirt and a very light blouse. And her sign said, if I can remember it really well, her sign said, "My shirt might be short." Or what she said, "My shirt is short, but no." She said, "My skirt is not too small, your mind is." That's what she said. You know, so there's just some clever things. People were saying. There was one sign that just stuck with me too. It said, "We are not hysterical, we are historic." And this really is a historic watershed moment for women. But the challenges they face now, you know, where this movement goes now is going to be really difficult to see, because the judicial system and the political system in Mexico is just stacked against them. And when you talk to victims of crimes, women or men, it's just so difficult for them to get justice in this country. The impunity and the rampant crime just makes that a very high hurdle to climb.
Well, Carrie, thank you.
You're welcome.
That's Carrie Kahn, international correspondent in Mexico City. And joining us now, Steve Chiatakis with a preview of Greater LA coming up at 1 o'clock. Hello.
I've been touching everything in this studio, by the way, and then
that.
I just touched my face.
Okay.
So things are not going well.
No.
And I suppose everybody's having this issue, right? Do you, like, think about how many times you touch your face?
I try not to. Someone just reminded me I just touched my face, and I tried to do it with my sleeve.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Not. We're going to get an update on coronavirus here in L.A. County, because they just had a briefing moments ago, the public health department. Now it's 16 confirmed cases in L.A. County, one of whom may have gotten it through the community spread that they're investigating now. So there we are. We're going to have the latest coming up in just a few minutes.
Okay. Stay tuned for that. Greater L.A. and Steve Chiatakis. Coming up, Cool of Cool and the Gang tells us how he came up with Celebration and his other iconic songs next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Bram. You have never not heard that song. Chances are you are grooving to it right this very second. You've heard it at a wedding, no doubt, a graduation, a campaign rally, wherever. You have heard that song a million times. Well, Cool and the Gang's anthem turns 40 this summer, and we're going to celebrate, with band leader and co-founder Robert Cool Bell. Welcome to the show, Cool.
How are you doing, Madeline?
I am doing great. That song never gets old. It's just such a great song. And when your group wrote that, you wanted it to be an anthem, right?
Well, my brother came up with the idea. We were out in L.A., and we had just won 2 American Music Awards for Ladies' Night. At the end of Ladies' Night, we speak about this is your night celebrating. And he played the song for us, and it had that kind of down-home groove to it, you know, like the down south, sitting on the porch in your grandmother's rocking chair, and then you say, "Yahoo! How you feeling today?"
Anyway. Who came up with that part? Yahoo! Did that just come out spontaneously, or was it written?
No. When we're in the studio, we just let it all come out, you know. And one of the guys said, "Hey, we could put that in a song."
Did you have any idea that it would become such a huge hit?
No, we didn't. Actually, I mean, Ladies' Night was huge, and it was the beginning of audition to the band, adding a lead singer.
Mm-hmm.
The name is James J.T. Taylor. Ladies' Night was the first song he did with us.
Mm-hmm.
When we did Celebration, and it was Too Hot, and all the other songs that was on that album, Celebration just took off.
Let's just hear a little clip from Ladies' Night, because now I need to hear it.
Oh, yes, it's Ladies' Night, and the feeling's right. Oh, yes, it's Ladies' Night. Oh, what a night. Oh, what a night. Yes, it's Ladies' Night, and the feeling's right.
It just has that. I mean, it really has also a disco vibe to it. So this is 1979, right? That this was released?
Yes, that was during the time of Studio 54. And my wife and I, we used to hang out in New York. And then on the weekends, there was always a ladies' night. So I said, wow, that's a great idea. Let me take that back to the guys. Because we were just putting the album together. I said, hey, I got a perfect song for this album. They said, oh, what? I said, ladies' night, man. That's how it happened.
So you grew up in New Jersey, right, with the other guys in the band?
Yes.
When did you start making music together?
Well, we started back in 1964. My brother and I, we were born in Youngstown, Ohio. We came to Jersey City in 1960, and we formed the first group in 1964.
And how old were you then?
14.
You were just 14?
Yes, I was a young guy. We all were young. And we called ourselves the Jazzy Acts. And then we changed the name to the Soul Town Band because Jersey City was trying to be like Motown. And we would have to learn these songs from the Motown hits because a lot of these guys in the group that was a part of Soul Town was singing Motown hits. And one of the masters of ceremony for Soul Town came up with this idea, and he had a picture of the a big block of ice and fire on top and melting the ice. He said, how you guys like that? I said, oh, yeah, well, hey, we don't have a name right now. Just call us the Soul Town Band. So we became Cool in the Flames.
Cool in the Flames?
Cool in the Flames. That's what he had in the window. That didn't work because you had James Brown and the Famous Flames.
Oh, okay.
And we didn't want to have any problems with the Godfather. So we said, well, hey, we'll just change the name of the game. The music is, you know, R&B, funk. So that's how we became Cool in the Gang.
So how did you become Cool?
Well, Cool was a nickname. When I left Youngstown, Ohio, guys in the neighborhood had nicknames. Here's an old country boy around New York, Newark, and those big cities. So I had to try to fit in. I think being cool might work.
And cool with a K, not with a C.
With a K, right.
Cool with a K. In that time period, in the early 70s, there were these other big soul bands coming up too, Earth, Wind, and Fire and the Commodores. What was your relationship like with those other acts?
The Commodores, excuse me, we used to work with them up in Harlem. We started doing some shows together with the Commodores around New York. And then Earth, Wind, and Fire, we worked with them in their earlier years. They were more West Coast, of course, so places like Maverick Flats and some of those early clubs out there. And then you had Parliament Funkadelics, you had George Clinton, you had Ohio Players, you had, you know, the Barcades. It was a whole lot of us out there.
And a lot of you guys would play on Soul Train.
Yes.
I want to play a clip of tape from 1974.
And as they join us again, featuring Mr. Donald Boyce on the vocals, let's see if we've got enough steam left to do that jungle boogie with Cool in the Gang.
That's another good one. So many hits, Cool. So many hits. So you had a lot of exposure on Soul Train and American Bandstand back in those days. How did things change in the 80s with MTV?
Well, MTV took a little while for us to get on MTV, but MTV was different. You're talking video, a whole different approach to the music thing, you know?
Yeah.
Soul Train and Bandstand, you actually doing your thing. Videos were videos. That's a whole nother part of the industry at that time. But MTV was very strong, very powerful at making things happen.
But you got more play on like Soul Train and shows like that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Soul Train and American Bandstand and the one with Wolfman Jack.
There
was a few shows out there during that time.
I guess I'm wondering, since these songs are played so often. I mean, I just heard Celebration at Joe Biden's celebration after he won South Carolina. Do you get royalties every time that song is played, or any of your songs?
Well, I mean, Warner Chappell's a publisher, so I'm quite sure they was tracking. And I was actually in Saudi Arabia when that happened.
So you heard about it. You heard that Joe Biden used your song at his
campaign event. I'm hearing about it from you.
Oh, just now. Okay. Well, guess what? I mean, how do you feel about that? Your song's being used in a political setting.
We're very happy about Celebration. I mean, we're talking about 40 years of Celebration. And about a year ago, maybe a year and a half, they played Celebration at the space station when the astronauts got up.
Oh,
they was floating around, celebrating good times. Come on.
That must have felt really great.
That felt very good. I said, wow, we're in space.
Well, does it feel a little different when a politician uses it and maybe a politician you don't support?
That's a hard one to control because of the song Celebration.
Mm-hmm.
I remember one time, I think it was Bush and Gore,
mm-hmm.
and we got a call from the Democrats, and we got a call from the Republicans to play for the inauguration.
Did you say yes to both of them or no to both of them?
We just waited to see what was going to happen.
Well, so did we all. And boy, did we wait. So I want to play another song of yours. You're known for your party songs, obviously, but you also have ballads, and this one in particular is a chart topper. With your wife for many years, correct?
Yes.
And what was your working collaboration like?
First of all, she did a lot of our uniforms, so she was in the fashions. She's also set up a foundation called the Cool Kids Foundation, and we also set up Just Cool Enterprises. During that time, we came up with Le Cool Champagne, which is coming out this year. It's a champagne that was out of Champagne Country up in Reims.
Mm-hmm.
Also, we have a cologne, which is called Just Cool. But these are the things that my wife and I were working on. Recently, I lost my wife a year ago, though.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
But I'm still pushing her, you know, the project that we said that we were going to do, and I'm still doing it.
Mm. And your son is also in the business, right?
Yes, he's a writer, rapper. His name is, he goes by the name of Prince Hakeem. He's a DJ also, so I got a chance to go out and check him out, and he's pretty much on it because he has the knowledge of the music of the 70s and the 80s.
Well,
and
he
then
better.
When he raps on Celebration. That's a simple one.
Oh, he does.
He comes out with us. Yeah, he comes out with us, and he does a little rap on Hollywood Swinging.
Uh-huh.
And also Celebration. Matter of fact, we did 48 shows with Van Halen about 2 or 3 years ago. And they loved them out there, you know, and David and all those guys. Yeah, we had a great time with the Van Halen.
That is quite a combination, you guys and Van Halen.
It was. But you know what? It worked. Yeah, it worked.
Yeah.
I remember... David was saying that, hey, in the 70s, we used to play Jungle Boogie and Hollywood Swinging in the clubs when it was first starting out in L.A.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that 60% of our audience are ladies. I said, oh. And he said, you guys wrote Ladies Night. I said, yes. And he said, in the 80s, we had Jump and you guys had Celebration. I said, yes. He said, let's go out and have a party, cool. Come on, man, let's do it. And that's how it happened.
Wow, just like that.
Just like that.
Yeah.
And he was right. Because when we play Ladies Night, you talk about, you know, 10, 20,000 people. Those ladies got up. And whoever was with them, he said, you better get down on it. Because we're going to celebrate.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show today. Really appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
That is Robert Cool Bell, co-founder of Cool and the Gang.
Oh, what you gonna do? You wanna get down? Tell me. Oh, what you gonna do? Do you wanna get down? Oh, what you gonna do? You wanna get down? Oh, what you gonna do? You wanna get down? Tell me.
Okay, that's a good way to end the show. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.